Brighten up your home with help from Menards. Illuminate your home with LED light bulbs from Fight Electric. They provide light that lasts with a rated life of over 10,000 hours. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Fight Electric LED light bulbs now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Hello, Todd.
Hey, Todd, it's Brianna.
Hey, what's happening, Brianna?
How you doing?
Good, good. Just working away here. Trying to make a living.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
No problem. That's awesome.
You, my friend, are a craftsman.
Well, some days I do all right. There are other days where I kind of wonder about myself.
I think that's all of us. But no, seriously, what you do, you make spurs and bits, and it's all very custom work, right?
Yeah, I build everything from scratch. So silverwork, whether I'm doing a brooch or a set of saddle silver or a pair of spurs or a bit, it's all fun. I can't keep it all mixed up and never a dull day.
Well, I mean, what you do is something, you know, to me, when I look at jobs that people do, you know, some things are kind of self-explanatory, not degrading them, but then some things that people do, it takes a level of experience. Like, you have to do it in order to get to a certain level.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
That's probably...
You got to have a lot of stuff in the circular file.
Yeah. Like, somebody can just start making spurs.
Yeah. You just got to know how to, you know, you've got to throw in a lot of stuff away and learn by trial and error. And hopefully you've had some good mentors to coach you through stuff and throw rocks at your work. And but, you know, you just have to do that. It's the only way to be better in study.
Oh, yeah.
I've been doing this almost 18 years, and there's not a day go by that I don't learn something new.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, in order to get to your level, it ain't like you just popped up one Monday and said, I'm going to start making spurs, and you was doing it, you know, in a month. Like, you know, what you do takes a lot of time in order to, you know, and you just said you've been doing it 18 years. Did you start off, like, with just bits and spurs, or did you start off under somebody?
No, I just started building spurs, farting around. I was riding with Corey Hendrickson, who's a NRHA judge, and he was a trainer at the time, and he said, hey, I want to show you something I've been working on when I work with the farrier, and when Alan shows up, and he said, showed me a pair of raft spurs, and I went home, and I thought, you know, I got some rafts I shoe, and I was like, I could part around with that, and the next week, I came back with a pair that were almost as good as the ones they spent a year farting around on.
Oh, wow.
And Jesse Asmussen was there riding with us that day, and he's gone on, and he said, can you build me a pair, because he's got really long legs. And I said, yeah. And the light bulb went on. He went on to win, I think, 3 NRHA non-pro titles so far.
Cool.
And most of them wearing my spurs. So it's pretty cool. The light bulb went on right there, and I've been doing it ever since. And then graduated on into doing bits. That was the next progression into, you know, if you go into anybody's tack room, they're going to have 2 or 3 pairs of spurs and 10 to 20 bridles.
Yeah.
So just doing the math and trying to think ahead, you know, bits were the next progressive step, and then
those are probably harder to do. I mean, I would think, I might be wrong, than spurs. I mean, that's probably next level up, is mastering bits.
Yeah, you know, it's fun because that's the challenge. I mean, you're trying to match whatever tools of the trade that person needs. They're an individual, and they're riding an individual. And so you're trying to build a tool that helps mesh that person and that horse at that point in the training program.
Right.
Because that's all subject to change any given day. And then if you're riding mares instead of geldings, then you have another problem. You know, it comes back to that ride the horse that you have that day.
Yeah.
And so you may need 20 bridles hanging on your wall because you might need, you know, something different today. They'll tell you.
Yeah.
And same with, you know, it's just, that's part of being the horseman is not being mechanical. It's having feel and finding that tool that you need. And then hopefully I come into the picture and can build you different pieces that allow you to feel that.
Now you ride too, right? Do you ride in and show? You ride?
Yep.
You show and ride, correct?
Yep. I've rode Rainers for about 25 years.
Oh, wow.
Been around it a long, long, long time. I did my undergrad work in River Falls, Wisconsin, at the horse program there. I have a degree in agriculture education. And I went through the horse program, and that's where I really got influenced with the reiners. And of course, I was fighting bulls and rodeoing really hard at that time. And so the reiners kind of took a back seat until I finally got close to retiring after a bad accident and going from there. So I've just been doing it ever since.
That's what I was fixing to say. You had a bad rodeo accident.
I had a lot of those, but I had a skydiving accident in 98.
Skydiving. Okay, I read that wrong.
Yep, I did. I had about 250 jumps at the time. 200, oh, wow. About 200. And I was at the World Skydiving Convention in Freefall Convention in Quincy, Illinois, and I did a hook turn at about 100 feet. My canopy would drop 250 feet, and so doing the math, I hit the ground doing about 70 and bounced 5 feet and crushed everything.
Dang.
Literally, I crushed almost every bone in my body. And
holy cow.
Yeah, I was out for about 3 weeks, just out, and came to, and they started putting me back together after a couple of days, and I was back fighting bulls in about 6 to 9 months.
I was fixing to say, you didn't go back skydiving, did you?
Yeah, I did. I went back jumping.
Oh.
I went back for 3 or 4 years, and then I took a 20-year hiatus, and then I got back last summer jumping some, and it was fun. It was awesome. I enjoyed it immensely. It's one of my favorite things to do in the world.
I mean, that was probably a mental healing along with physical healing from that, just to get over the fear of it happening again. Or maybe you don't have that. I don't know. I would have been scared.
You know, I don't remember much of the accident per se. So it's not quite that bad, but you know, I mean, physically every day you feel the retributions of it. But
right. That's
when I got back into really riding. That helped my physical therapy immensely. Was riding.
Oh, wow.
and having that muscle memory from, I started riding when I was a little kid. I think I had my first pony when I was 3. And so that balance and that muscle memory really helped me to recuperate and get the coordination back. I wasn't at the level that I was before I got hurt, but I went back and fought for another 5 or 6 years. I couldn't go to the Wrangler Freestyle Tour. I just wasn't quite that physical. But I could save cowboys with the best of them and enjoyed it. I was the alternate to the NFR twice in the Wrangler Bullfight Tour.
That's cool.
And I had a very successful year. I got career in the rodeo business. I got to fight bulls for almost 25 years, start to finish.
Well, that's crazy that you went from bullfighting, rodeo, to reining. I mean, that's kind of like, you know, most people that are in from rodeo, they'll end up going into stock contracting or like auctioneer or something of that, like, nature, mm-hmm. but you went terraining.
Horses have always been. I've been a cowboy. I was raised a cowboy, and I had the opportunity to get back into the Rainers and be around them. My best friend who won the non-pro fraternity, Chad Clark, who won the non-pro fraternity in 06, he looked at me one day, and I mean, I was crippled. This is when I was trying to rehab. And he said, you need to get on some Rainers. You can do this. And I like, you know, because I just wanted to go drink beer with Chad.
Right.
Up at the Rainers. And
the last thing on his mind.
Yeah, you know, and I was like, all right. So, I mean, I literally had to walk myself when I got back to riding. I had to break down and write down every step that I had to do physically to make a turn or maneuver the horse, and had to reteach my body to, you know, do those steps. One, I'd had enough concussions that I couldn't remember, and if I didn't write those down, and two, I had to reteach my body to, you know, move in certain ways in a certain sequence of maneuvers to communicate with the horse. So it was a long road, really long road. But
yeah, I was fixing to say, like, not just the healing aspect of putting yourself back together, but the healing aspect of redoing your body to, like, what you just said. So how long do you think it took from, like, a year or two? Like, how long do you think
it took for you to get... Years.
Oh, wow.
I went to a myofascial release massage type technician for a long, long time, just because the soft tissue damage was just crazy with the scar tissue and stuff. I mean, the pain and the knots and things like that in my legs and the rest of my body. Wow. It was really a dramatic thing to kind of get over and get through, but I'm better for it, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you kind of speak a little light of it, but I'm sitting here thinking, that's a big deal. Like, it's not, you know, that's a big deal. But it's cool that you got, you know, you got through it and you didn't let it stop you and you're back to it now. But, so.
You know, at a certain point, I decided I was going to live and I had to figure out what I was going to do with myself.
Yeah.
Survival, you know, and when I got to building spurs and kind of, it just took off, like I said, with Jesse and Peter DeFreitas buying, you know, making my first orders was huge. And it took off from there. And I, that's all I do for the last 10 years, basically, is just build bits and spurs. I shoe a little bit on the side to have fun and meet people. Yeah. But for the most part, I'm in the shop 7 days a week creating and building something.
Yeah, it's so cool to see the whole process. Now, if somebody, you know, let's say they order something on Monday and they order a custom bit, about how long does it take? I mean, this thing, what you do isn't something you can whip up in a week or two. It probably takes a good amount of time.
Right now, I'm about 6 months out on orders. I was over a year, but I'm getting set up. But start to finish, I mean, if I'm just building a plain pair, I can build those in a day. The silver work may take another day to 4 or 5 days, depending on what, you know, what exactly we're doing on them. Like today, I have a logo that I was cutting out and it was really a lot of little tiny letters on this logo. And I got the first one almost done, and I had over an hour in cutting in it. And I cut it wrong, and I had to start over. Throw that one in the corner, and, you know, it had a little nick in it. You know, for me, it wasn't gonna work, so I scrapped it.
Right.
But some of it can be very tedious and slow, and you can't be in a hurry. And when I lay out a project, I do it a lot of it on the computer. I use Corel Draw, so I can shrink and enlarge things to within 0.01 of an inch. And then when I print it out, I know it will fit the spur exactly.
Oh, wow.
And then
so
I
you need a bunch of vectors. So you work with more vector images and things of that nature then. Okay.
Yeah, they're a little more precise and clean
to
cut. Some printers are better than others. So it's I've had that learning, you know, what kind of equipment works for the money. And then I use a jeweler saw to cut it all out, and I'll use different blades. Some blades are as small as a horse tail hair. I mean, they're that tiny.
Holy cow.
Those today. I can't even, on a 5-aught blade, I can't see the kerf on the blade. I can feel it, and I know which way to put it in my saw, but I can't see it without, you know, some big magnifying glasses. So you're cutting that tiny of stuff.
See, now you didn't tell me something. I thought you would have used a CNC machine.
Mm-mm. No, I cut it all by hand.
Everything.
The only computer type stuff that I use is actually in my layouts. I use Procreate to draw a lot on my iPad, and then I can send that to my computer and resize it and fit it to what I want to fit it to. If I'm doing a lot of floral type work where it's got a lot of vines and leaves and things like that. And then that process adds another 2 or 3 days to a project. To just do the drawings, a lot of times will take more than a day or two. Sometimes I'll do some drawings and throw them in the corner and kind of think on them a little bit and come back to them in a day. Or that, you know, just trying to figure that layout that works the best.
That makes me feel better as far as logos, because I do some, not a lot of them, you know, a little bit of them every now and then. Somebody will want a logo, and sometimes they'll go just real like, yep, that's perfect, let's do it, let's roll with it. And then sometimes it's like, I got to think on this for a minute, like I can't, you know, my brain, and then it'll take a couple of days, you know.
Yep, I know exactly, you know, and you look at it and it just doesn't look right, and you don't know why.
Yeah.
And you just got to kind of stew on it. And that's just part of the creative process of it. And I am not an artist by any stretch, but I'm getting to be a better craftsman. And I think that's just two different thought processes. But I know what looks pretty, and I know what's appealing to my eye.
Right.
That helps a lot.
Well, you still got to wear a lot of multiple hats in the bigger picture of it. I mean, you still have to have some type of creativity and have to have some type of this and that to make it all kind of work together, you know, because, I mean, not everybody can make it run smoothly like you're doing. So,
the hard part, you know, you got to wear, that's why I'm mostly bald, because I got to wear so many different hats. It's just me, myself, and I. And those other two are drunks and looking for work comp claims, so it's just me. But that's the challenge, you know, because, like this week it's manufacturing and next week it might be drawing and sales. You know, if I go to a show, I got to put on my sales hat and you're pimping your material, you know, that you've been building or trying to get orders and things like that. But, like when I go to a show, I'll have 15 bridles with me usually, demo bridles. And I'll have my demo spurs and stuff like that. And you know, the best way to do it is get on and ride with them. If you buy a new truck, you're going to want to drive it before you buy it. So, those and, you know, have two armfuls of bridles, and somebody wants you to consult on what bridle to use. And we just go to the warm-up pen and try this one, try this one, try that one, you know, and I can watch them go around and kind of have an idea what, you know, what works, because I show. I train my own and ride my own. I don't do outside horses, but I know what works in my hands, and I know what the capabilities and the purposes of the bridles that I build in their capabilities. So different bloodlines will tend to lead to different kinds of bridles. You know, that those are all things that you kind of keep in the back of your head.
That's what I was trying to say. Like, the horse experience that you have has helped you as far as being able to add to, you know, building bits and spurs and stuff like that, you know, you're able to put a little bit more into it as far as if it was someone who just, you know, didn't have that type of experience.
Right. And that's what allows me to be a better bit and spur maker, because I'm going to go to the barn at 5:30 and I'm going to test whatever I've got, you know, for the day. If I've got something new, you know, it's like, okay, how does this feel in my hands? What are the reactions? And sometimes you come back and you throw it in the garbage and it's like, that doesn't work.
Right.
That's what's fun. And that's what gives me an advantage over other makers. Some of them are better machinists and maybe have better equipment and are more efficient at building it or welding it. But a lot of them don't have the feel for the actual tool and what it does in your hands. No. So it keeps you humping, keeps you going.
Right. Now, better. You said you did saddle conchos too?
Absolutely. I just redid. I didn't like the conchos on mine, so I redid the conchos and corner plates on my show saddle, actually.
Oh, cool.
I don't do a lot of saddle silver, but I do use some. I work with a few different saddle makers, and usually it's a custom order for somebody.
Right.
I use like Don Rich saddles. I do a lot of those, or have in the past. But I can do those for anybody. I can do saddle silver for anybody. Put logos on, you know, or initials on conchos or those kinds of things. Once you kind of get a grip on the silver work, it's very transferable to different disciplines and different applications.
Right.
And that's what's fun. And sometimes you just need a change up, even though it's the same steps in your head, you know, okay, I'm going to do a wild rag ties today. So, you know, you're thinking a little different and different sizes and different shapes and design different things. It keeps you fresh.
Yeah, well, I bet it does. Something, add something different in there every now and then. That's good for anybody, no matter what they do, you know.
Absolutely.
You can make more mistakes when you get dumb, is what I say. When I get slow, I feel like I get dumb. When I get fast, I get smart.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that's how, because we do a bunch of hats for Cross State Tech, and they sell Don Rich. Everybody loves Don Rich. They're nice saddles.
Yeah.
So what made you end up in Tennessee? Because you went from Wisconsin, now you're in Tennessee.
Yeah. I did my undergrad work in River Falls, Wisconsin, and then I moved to Texas for a long time when I was fighting hard. Lived in North Texas, and then I after I got hurt, then I moved to Illinois and got married, and then we moved down here about 8 years ago, just looking for a change and different conservative-type place in the world. Illinois is not conservative, and that just, you know, didn't work.
Well, yep, that's all he's got to say.
Yep, and anyway, got out of there while we could, and I loved it down here. I knew a few people down here from my rodeoing days, and that was about it. I enjoyed it here a lot. And then my
There's
life.
No property tax, right? Or no sales
Pardon?
Tax? Is there no sales tax?
There's sales tax, and the property taxes are really, really reasonable here.
I was told there was no sales tax or no property tax. I haven't been lied to.
Income tax in Tennessee.
Income tax, that's it.
Yep. But there is a little higher sales tax, but when it's compared to what Illinois was, it's almost a wash. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but I loved it. I loved it here, and I stayed. I got single about 3 years ago, and I am just enjoying just doing exactly what I want to do and building cool stuff and riding horses and going to shows. And I help my neighbor out foaling babies in the spring. So it's pretty crazy right now with babies coming. And
oh yeah, that's right. It is that time of the year.
Yes, it is. We got a highbrow cat on the ground, that, that's pretty awesome. The modern technology of breeding has changed the horse business dramatically in all disciplines, of course, but it's pretty cool to see a baby buy a stud that's been dead over 10 years.
That is why. Wow.
That is pretty cool. So
yeah, you just kind of put it into more of a perspective when you said it like that. Like, you know, we got a baby from a horse that's been dead for over 10 years. Like, you know.
You know, it's to be around that kind of technology in the horse business is game-changing. The procedure called ICSI, where they go in and harvest the embryo or the ovocytes from the mare and actually inseminate one frozen semen into one ovocyte and then grow it in a petri dish. And if it matures, then it's put into a recip mare. And,
yeah.
And then ta-da.
Well, we had this conversation with another on another episode with another girl we were talking about, because she grew up in the cattle industry, and
yep.
We were talking about how, or she was telling me, because I don't know anything about cows, she was telling me how that technology has actually been around in the cow world, and it's weird how horses have taken this long to kind of come up to it. But I guess, I mean, you know, with you and I talking, it might not have been needed yet. I mean, the want for the horse lifestyle has increased so much over the past couple of years, it would make sense for it to start booming now, I would assume, you know?
It has, you know. I mean, but in the equine end of it, it's an extremely expensive procedure. So, you know, it's not for the masses. Recip mares are going to be, you know, they're going to cost $5,500. Or more a year, you know, just for that, let alone. So, I mean, it's nothing to be able to have 10,000 or more in a baby before he ever even hits the ground.
Good God.
You know, but that's easy. If you go down, you know, if you're playing in those kinds of games.
Right.
In the horse business. So I just like to stick over my corner and build my stuff.
Now, how many horses do you have?
I just have one. I've got a solid maturity horse. I'll show it the maturities this year for 8 and overs. I raised her from a baby. I showed her mom, and I picked her dad and put the deal together and foaled her and trained her myself. Nobody's ever really swung a leg on her, and we've been very successful over the years. So that's very rewarding. I enjoy that part of it. But
yeah,
get a baby out of her another year or two. And kind of go down that road.
Yeah.
But,
so I enjoy
riding security horses and derby horses and that challenge and being around people that are doing the same in the range
right.
business. That's
yeah.
kind of my forte. I've been around them most of my horse career, and I enjoy the preciseness of the maneuvers and the training techniques. The discipline is extremely accelerated in the last, you know, 10 years. It's crazy to see the quality of horses that are out there now compared to when I started. It's pretty amazing. You go to the show pen, sit at the warm up and watch the horses walking in, and you know, every one of those horses is gorgeous. And extremely talented physically. You know, and 20 years ago, it wasn't that way. So it's cool to see the changes over time.
Well, the payout for these shows have increased dramatically. I mean, you know, like the money that's put into these shows have increased a lot. So it all makes sense for it to keep going up like it's been going up. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
It's not just it is a hobby for most people that are showing it, but it's not. It's becoming a lot of people are ending up investing into it as a business, you know.
It's a side business. You know, I mean, you have to look at it like that. You know, they're not backyard horses. They're athletes. And you're building tools, or I'm building tools for athletes, and I'm showing athletes, and you have to think on a sports medicine kind of a point of view with those horses too. I mean, everything from massages and veterinary techniques that are out there, and you know, from injecting joints to keeping them physically fit. You just don't grab them up and take them to a show. You rode them for 6 weeks before you ever even ask them to, you know, do a hard maneuver, because, you know, physically it's very taxing on their body. So they got to be in shape. They got to be like an NFL football player or a college football player. You got to be in shape. I guess that's always a pet peeve of mine, is watching people, you know, pull the horse out of the pasture and take him to a barrel racing. I'm sure you see that, you know, and wonder why he's hurting, or he's sore, or he's grumpy, or he's not running hard, or whatever. It's like, he's not in shape.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And the people have to be in shape too. That's you know, if you're not in physical shape, you can't, and your horse is not in physical shape, you cannot go at this business and think that you are going to be productive.
Well, that mentality in itself is not going to get you anywhere. Anybody that thinks they could just hop up one day and go win something without putting in the work that it takes, you're not going to get very far.
Right. You know, and this
actually is a good point. You know, the horse industry is not something you can just pop up one day and be like, all right, well, I'm going to start this on Monday and we're going to be winning by Friday. I mean, regardless of the money you've got into it or the type of animal you got, like, it's a type of persistent and consistent hard work that goes into anything that you want to endeavor within the horse industry.
Yeah.
And
they're an animal. They have good days, bad days, emotions, ups and downs. They feel good or they feel bad some days. They're not a machine. You don't go and turn them on and turn them off. You know, their struggle through, you know, being an athlete is our responsibility to take care of them and bring them along in a professional manner so that they have a longevity in the business. You're not going to burn them out mentally or physically. Back and adds back into, you know, what tools are you going to use to get the job done? You know, are you going to use a correction today? Are you going to use a solid mouthpiece today? Are you going to have a long shank or a short shank? What are you trying to help your horse accomplish?
Spurs or bits?
Both. Absolutely both. Like, if a customer comes to me and wants a pair of spurs, mean to make a pair, one, I'm going to make a band that actually fits their boot correctly, that's not too big or too small. The shank is going to be a length and pin height and shape that's conducive to the actual discipline that they're competing in or playing in, so that you're not pestering your horse, but you're still getting to your horse efficiently. If you're short-legged, traditionally you have a shorter shank because you're going to be closer to your horse, and vice versa. And the respect from the horse comes from the rowel, not from the length of the shank. So if he's a dull-sided horse, you can go with a little sharper rowel. If they're really feely, you're going to go to a duller rowel. So that you can get a consistent cue to your horse. So it's just about building that tool that you need and then staying consistently asking that horse over and over to teach him what you're trying to achieve. So they're just a tool. They're just an extension of your leg.
Yeah, but I think you are right. It does depend on what horse that you're using them on. Because you have some, I mean, I've seen some horses, you could stick a freaking hole in the side of their belly and they would not care. They would not budge. They would not move. It don't bother them. And then you have some horses, I've seen some horses, you could just even think about it and they'll move their, you know, that are really, really sensitive and just move their whole body over. So that's got to play a part in you helping a customer build a set of spurs if they need them or not need them. I mean, you would think they would know if they need them or not, but,
You know, like most, most of the trainers that I build spurs for, they'll have three pairs. They'll have three different rowels in them, depending on the horses that they are going to ride that day.
Yeah.
You know, so they, you don't want to, you can change the tool and be effective, and you don't have to change the way you communicate to your horses so that you can be consistent with every horse that you get on. So that your legs can be slow, easy, and effective, and then they just respect whatever rowel you have in your spurs.
Right.
They're not push on you. They're not going to lean on you. But you're not going to scare them. They just have to respect it.
And how many different rowels are there, would you say, off the top of your head? Because I've seen some that are, like, huge, and they're actually really not that intimidating if you think about it. They're just big in size, and you have little ones. And
It depends on how thick they are, because the thinner ones are going to be sharper.
Right.
And the amount of space between the tines. So if the space is really close, they're going to be softer. And the farther apart and the pointier the tips of those tines are, the sharper they're going to be. Pretty much, probably about 10 different rowels are very common in the business.
You know, yeah.
A small 8, a big 8, a 9-point, a 10-point, a sharp 10, a big 10, a 12-point, a 16-point, and a rock grinder are the dominant rowels that are in the performance horse business. But there are, you know, there are people that want to have bumper spurs or ball bearing spurs. You know, they're just have like a 3/4-inch ball bearing on the end that you're just bumping on the horse with.
Right.
You know, some of them are more effective, some of them aren't. You know, if you're running cans and you're running 100 miles an hour, you're inadvertently going to be bumping on your horse. You don't want to have a long shank. So I'm going to build a tool for you, depending on your discipline. You know, that will have an influence on it, how I create it.
Okay, so now let's say they're a ranch pony. Let's say they're non-reining, non-barrel or anything. Let's say they're doing ranch. You know, what can you take that type of customer and help them build what they need in order to do the ranch stuff? Because you would think, well, I mean, I would think they're bumping on their horse, or maybe they're not.
Absolutely. I want to know how tall they are. I want to know how long their inseam is, the kinds of horses that they're riding. Are they riding colts predominantly? You know, we're going to do some things different there. If you're...
Whoa. Why does that matter?
Because you're probably going to do a softer rowel.
Ah, that's interesting.
Sure. Why do you want to scare them?
Right. No, but I mean, it's interesting that the fact that if they're a colt or not is going to matter to you regardless of anything else. I wouldn't think that would matter.
Yeah. I mean, I want to get a reaction from my legs with the least amount of work, but you still want to intimidate them, you know, and some days they're going to be push, you know, a little pushier than others. Maybe they need a little more. But traditionally, a lot of colt riders will just ride with a really soft, short shank.
Gotcha.
Because you don't want to, you know, if one grabs their butt and takes off with you, you don't want to be squeezing on them trying to hang on with a long shank. You're just going to throw gas on the fire.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now it makes sense. Okay.
But if you're riding old ranch horses that have been around forever, you know, and are broke and solid and doing their thing, you know, might do something a little bit different. But if you're 6'3" versus 5'4" and you wear a 13 boot compared to a 7, that whole spur is going to be totally different sizes for that person. You're building a tool for that person and the horses that they ride.
That's pretty detailed. I mean, because, you know, I mean, if you want it to be correct and work with your boot correctly, because, I mean, how many times have we seen somebody just buy a random set of spurs and then they end up having to put something in the middle of them, or they have to use mm-hmm. a rubber band, or they have to use something to accommodate it? Mm-hmm. That's kind of nice to be able to have them really seriously custom made to size.
And every boot is different. And the boot manufacturers, you know, they have a different last or size or shape. You know, another question I ask my customers, where do you wear your spurs? Do you wear them down on the actual heel, or do you wear them up on the deck of the heel? That all comes to play as to how I shape that band. If it's up high above, you know, setting on the top of the heel ledge, I'm going to build it more V-shaped. If you wear them down on the actual heel, some people like that, I'm going to build them U-shaped. They're going to fit that radius of that heel has to fit where you put your spurs. If you wear a 13 boot, I'm going to build a way wider radius in the heel of that spur than I would if you wear a 7. It all makes a difference.
Now, what if they use a different pair of boots?
I prefer to have them wear, or I measure the boots that they wear the most. Yeah. And that's their everyday boots. I've run into people that their everyday boots are a heavy-hided boot, maybe a bull hide or a water buffalo or something. And then they go to the show and they wear an ostrich or a lizard at the show. Totally different thickness of leather, and it'll make a whole different size in the spur. So
that's what I was sitting here thinking. Most people's work boots, you know, at home, like barn boots, are different than the ones they show in, most of them.
Yep. So you try to hit that happy medium. We're creatures of habit, so we will wear, once we find a boot that we like, we'll stick with that for as long as they manufacture that boot style. So I you know, you kind of hit the middle of it. My spurs are heavier than most people. Most spurs out there on the market, you're not going to put them between your knees and squeeze them and resize them. But there are ways of adjusting them if we need to.
That's a good thing that you can't do that, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I use a vise a lot, and you can just squeeze them down or open them up with a vise. But, you know, the days of putting them between your knees and squeezing them doesn't work.
You just made me think about something. When was the last time you seen a lace-up, like, roper boot? You remember them? Not a lot of people wear them anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of guys wear those outfitters and stuff will wear those kinds of boots out west in the mountains and stuff. They're a pretty popular boot, actually.
They used to have these little silver pieces that you could buy to go on the tongue that come out. Do you remember them?
Yeah,
those were real popular kind of back in the day. That's why I figured you probably remember seeing them. People used to wear them all the time. It was a hype.
Along with every colored boot that you could imagine.
Well, yeah, that was like Wrangler jeans. I remember they had... You know, you used to buy different color jeans. It's cool to see the way the trends just change throughout the years, you know. Our nylon belts, remember that? Those were
Or the parachute cord ones.
Yeah. You didn't even have to have like the end of the buckle for a you know, when you had your belt on, you just kinda use your belt buckle to just hook it wherever you wanted to.
Yep, exactly. One size fits all.
Yeah. Now, do you get into buckles and stuff like that too, or no? You're clear of those? Yep.
I do a few buckles. Like I said, silver work. It just depends on what you want. I don't do lot of trophy buckles and stuff because there's manufacturers out there that can do them much faster than I can.
Yeah.
They've got the big presses and, you know, that's all they do. I like building buckles. It's fun. But it's something I don't do a lot of. I do a lot of headstall silver buckles and stuff for headstalls and things like that. That's a lot of fun. So anything, and, you know, and the great thing about silver work is when the leather work is wore out, you can take that silver work and put it on, you know, new headstalls.
Yeah.
That's what people think, that once the headstall is wore out, the silver's done and you got to get a whole new expensive one. Well, no, just get a new headstall and we'll put it on.
Yeah, just change the silver out.
That's the investment in good silver. Silver work, it will last you a long time.
Have you seen the difference between, like, I don't want to say crappy silver, but maybe silver plated stuff and just crappy made stuff versus something that's solid silver? Because that's what you use solid silver.
Yeah, you know, there's lots of different materials out there. A lot of the commercial buckle builders do a process of electrolysis where they're not using solid materials. It's almost like an electrolysis process. A very thin layer of sterling will go over the top of the whole piece, or copper or bronze. It'll give you the different colors and stuff. And I got into that when I was fixing a few buckles for some friends, and I went to heat one up and it just disintegrated.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'll fix old sterling buckles, the trophy buckles and stuff, because you can heat that up and it won't melt off. I had one buckle that, I mean, all the colors just melted. And that's just part of the process of how they can commercially make a trophy buckle for $150.
So the colors melted because it's just a thin layer of, like, this other separate material.
Yeah, it's a
okay.
100 thousandths of an inch thick. I mean, there's, you know, it's over the top of, you know, a steel base or nickel base or whatever that they cut the rate. It's just a teeny tiny layer over the top. Solid sterling stuff is hard. The cost wise of sterling is really high, and so you know, some people just can't afford or not going to pay for sterling.
Right,
you're going to add another $400 or $500 to a project just because you're going to make it out of sterling, solid sterling. It adds up.
Yeah.
I use German silver. I use sterling silver fill, which my silver comes in a sheet, like a 6x12 sheet when I start. Just looks like a cookie sheet. And I'll lay it out in a computer.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. This looks like a cookie sheet when I start. And it's different thicknesses. Whether it's bronze or copper or German silver or sterling fill. It's just a sheet. Looks like a cookie sheet. You know, that's all it looks like. And so depending on the project, I'm going to use a different thickness. Like buckles, I'm going to use 16 gauge or 14 gauge. Silver on overlays on a pair of spurs or a bit is going to be 22 gauge. What the challenge is in the engraving. So how do I make that cookie sheet that's only 22 gauge look like it's a half inch thick?
Right.
And give it depth and make it three-dimensional instead of two-dimensional. And that's where the engraving part of it really comes into play. and perfecting the depth of the cuts and the style of the cuts.
Yeah, because you're in great, because, you know, I say I do engraving. What I do is completely different than what you do. Like, we do like laser engraving, and it's just kind of, mm-hmm. you can do different depths and stuff, but it's just on leather. It's not like, it's a little more complicated when it comes to silver, because you've got to do those floral depths are different and compared yep. to the, you know, certain areas and things like that you guys are putting on there. It's a lot different. And plus metal, mm-hmm. engraving on metal is different than leather or wood and things of yep. that nature.
Yep. You know, it's just a different medium.
Right.
You know, so sometimes it has to do with the order of the cuts. Mm-hmm. We'll give it more depth than others. But I want that piece to jump up and have layers and be depth, you know, be thick and have some depth to it, and be three-dimensional. That, to me, that's what makes it pretty and yeah. and different. So I strive in my drawings and my projects that I'm working on is how do I make those scrolls and leaves and vines and stuff like that look like it's layered, and give it depth. And some of it is the how deep you're engraving and in the order of how you engrave it, to make some of those vines and leaves go over the top. The optical illusion of having things stacked up. It just comes into play. It's an ever-ending drawing process.
Look beautiful, so you're doing something right.
I do a lot of drawing on my iPad, and it allows me to practice without having to wreck a lot of stuff. Just work on the drawings and what works, and sometimes just having a piece of paper and a pencil. Doodling and playing.
Well, I mean, you know, I bet that can be challenging for somebody who's got a creative side. You've only got so much space and so much area to kind of work with, and so it can limit you as far as, you know, or even like with me or the back of a jacket, you've only got so much space mm-hmm. to do what you've got to do, you know. And
how do you please a customer that wants to put 3 tons of stuff in a 1-ton bag?
Right. Yes.
You know, and that's part of the person that sent me the logo that I'm working on right now. And it's like, oh, gosh, we've got to make this fit in 1 inch. And basically it's a billboard sign, you know, kind of a size. And it's like, okay, you want all of that information in 1 inch by 1.5 inches.
Yeah.
And got to figure out what looks good, you know, what's eye appealing and what's not eye appealing. And you can probably get it all stuffed in there, but it's not going to look right.
Yeah. No. Trust me. I completely agree. I've had to say this a couple of times for things like, I'll tell somebody, look, I will do it if that's what you want, but I'm going to go ahead and tell you right now, it's going to look like crap.
Yep. Fido's behind.
Because the size does, you know, the size of what you're working with matters a lot. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. You know, with engraving, you can get pretty detailed. But with thread's only so big.
Right.
So you're limited.
And it's limiting factors when your layouts and thinking yeah. about what are my limiting factors. And that's always my first question to myself. It's like, okay, where are my parameters and what are my limits?
Yeah. 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 There's literally only so much you can do. Like,
yep. And I'm sure you deal a lot with a lot of things with just what is eye appealing.
Yeah.
I was really lucky. It's funny how I was always told that, as a young person, that the jobs that you have, in life move you along to apply them to jobs in the future. And one of the jobs out of college was I was fighting bulls, and I had some time off, and I just went to work for Jostens in Red Wing, Minnesota at the time. Names and the diplomas on the actual paper, on the degrees.
Oh, you were doing calligraphy?
Yeah. Well, and it was on a machine, and you type in the words and things like that, but you had to go back and proof each one of those diplomas. And some fonts, some letters in some fonts might be mathematically centered, but to your eye, it wasn't centered. It didn't look right.
Yeah.
And that job, that 6 or 8 week job that I had that winter, it taught me how to see letters and how to look at them and how to offset them and to, anyways, long story short, 20 years later, 25 years later, I was using what I learned from that job and incorporating it into my bits and spurs and doing my silver work, because certain fonts and certain letters will look different and take up different space. And so trying to find center and making it eye appealing takes a little bit of training, I guess. And,
yeah, well, sometimes what the eye appeal is going to override whatever, like, for instance, if things need to be centered and you look at the numbers, you're like, all right, this is centered, this is centered, this is centered, but it still looks off. I'm going to go with it, what eye appeal. My eye appeal is going to override whatever is there, you know, because we do some engraving on knives and stuff, and this wood area is so little, and I've screwed up more knives than I care to admit. It's so little, and you know, on the machine, it'll be like, this is center, this is perfect, but to my eye, I'll be like, no, this is not right. So I'll go with what looks good, even though if you measure it out, it's probably not center, but it's going to look
right
best in that format.
Yep, and that's what I learned working for Jostens 25 years, 30 years ago, was just why and how come you need to move something over. And at the time, I was like, whatever, I'll never use this again. Yeah, well, ta-da, I'm making a living doing it.
Yeah, I would assume that you probably work with, like you said, you work with trainers who obviously do this for a living day in and day out. You know, they kind of have a set idea of the things, the tools that they need at different areas of that horse's career. That's really cool to be a part of that.
It is. I mean, it's fascinating every day to get to be around the caliber of trainers and horsemen that I get to be around. It's really, really fun. Really, really
like
fun.
You probably watch the shows and think, you know what, that horse would not be doing that if they didn't have them spurs on.
Well, you know, that comes into play. You see that.
I'm being lighthearted about it. Obviously, it's a lot of other factors, but that is really cool. I mean, if I was you, I would sit back and be like, I made them spurs.
Bridles. It's more for the bridles for me.
That
instant, it's like, okay, that horse is flipping his head, or he's doing this, or, he's not soft in the face, but he's an older horse, he's pushing on the bridle, what do we do, where can you go? Because when I go to the show pen as a reiner, you put your hand down, and, they have to be willingly guided, and if they're not, you're not going to mark, and the judges aren't going to mark you. And so you've got to find that communication point with that horse where you're just adding as little influence to them as possible, and they're still listening without scaring them.
Yeah, it's amazing to watch trainers. Like, I just still don't understand the whole – I would love to just be able to ride one once to understand the concept of how the rider communicates to the horse and make them do what they do. Just fascinates me. I just always thought it was so cool. Same thing with cutters.
Oh, absolutely. The cutters are, those horses are thinking all the time. They're thinking about
that.
And, you know, which is different than reiners, because we don't want that horse to think. we want him to wait on us, because we're going to run different patterns. We're going to do different maneuvers. We're going to do this or do that. And I don't want him outthinking me. I want him to listen to the command when I give that specifically, or we're going to end up in the penalty box.
So what is the command to make them slide? That's my biggest question. Is that seat? Because I don't never see a spur on them. I don't ever see a hand move. How do you tell the horse to slide?
I teach my horses that the word whoa means
oh,
back.
So verbal.
Oh, I have three check valves. One is my hand. If I have to go to my hand and pick up on their face, that means your butt better engage and go
right.
to the. If I ride with a lot of legs, if I my legs come off of their side and push forward a little bit with weight, they should be stopping and backing up. And it gets back to the breeding that we were talking about earlier. You know, these horses are natural, low-hocked. They want to stop or they want to turn. It's innate in their genetic makeup.
Yeah, they're just bred that way.
We're teaching, you know, it's just like racehorse. He's bred to run. Some horses are going to be faster than others. Some are going to be able to turn better. Some are going to be able to stop deeper. You know, everyone is an individual, but the breeding is there. Then we're just taking, you know, and enhancing that and getting them to do it prettier, softer, stop deeper or harder. It's kind of like, you know, in the cow horse deal, same way. You know, watching the cow horse is like more like watching college hockey in comparison, very physical, whereas the reining's more like figure skating, where it's more precise and timing and pretty more fluid in the maneuvers. Just the difference in the.
That's a great analogy of it, because that fits pretty perfect.
It's so awesome to get to be in the horse business. My life daily, weekly, monthly, yearly revolves around the horse business. And I'm putting boots and hat on every day. And after a while, you need to get a break from it. You get burnt out. And you got to figure out how to stay fresh in the business.
You're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, you know. So, is it, you know, where is your downtime? How do you clear your head and get away from it? The first, you know, I've gotten burned out at times. You know, it's just you're going through the motion. You know, you're welding every day, you're grinding every day, you're functioning. And for me, it's getting those projects that I can be creative on. Sometimes you just get into the function thing of it and you're not getting creative. And for me, when I get to get creative on something, then that's when it's fun. And brings back that little spark. Back into it.